Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you today live from Sandestin, Florida. Another beautiful day down here. I hope it's pretty where you are. Today marks a significant anniversary. I don't know if you have taken note of this or not, but it was 1 year ago today that Terry Schiavo died, a death court-ordered by starvation and dehydration. And we're going to be talking today about that anniversary. And I'm going to be asking this question: have we learned anything over the last year? Have the issues been further clarified in your mind? I fear what has happened over the last 12 months is that this entire question has been sidelined, and I think the ethic of personal autonomy has gained even more ground. I think some of those who fought on behalf of Terry's life a year ago might be even more reluctant to do so now, simply because of the cultural pressure this is being pushed back from the other side. We're going to be talking about what all this means and why we now face this great divide in America between those who believe that life is more important than autonomy on the one hand, and the others who believe that autonomy is more important than life. That great dividing line marks a great fissure down the center of our culture, and we're going to be talking about what that means. Get ready to call. I want to hear what you have to say in answer to that question. Have we learned anything over the last year? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to your questions and your calls in just a moment. First, a review of some other issues in the news. The abortion issue is back in an international context, and at my website at Albert Mohler, MOHLER.com, I posted a couple of articles over the last 48 hours that I think tell us a great deal. First of all, in India, Dr. Anil Subhini has been arrested and now even convicted, along with his x-ray technician, of offering to perform sex selection abortions in India. Now, we know how the situation has progressed there in India. We know that once the kind of technology was developed that would identify the gender or sex of a baby in the womb, the gender preference equation there in India kicked in, and what you had was the abortion of millions and millions of baby girls. The preference for baby boys in India is perhaps greater there than anywhere else in the world, and for many reasons it should concern us, quite frankly. But in this case, they're able to use this technology, and so all over India, in villages small now, given the price of the technology, and large, and in cities all across that country, there are commercial ultrasound offices where persons can go and get the sex of their baby identified as early as possible. And then if it's a baby girl, millions of Indians have been aborting those babies. There's another story, however, going on about abortion that's very important. And this one is not in India, but in North Korea. In North Korea, Dr. Kwang Choi, a physician, has now come out as a defector, suggesting that there are now no disabled persons in North Korea because, as a matter of state policy, they are simply being aborted. This doctor, Mr. Ri Kwang Chol, a physician, claims firsthand knowledge of this, although he says he was not involved in it. Reuters, a very respected international news agency, is reporting, and I quote, "North Korea has no people with physical disabilities because they are killed almost as soon as they are born," a physician who defected from the communist state said on Wednesday. Ri Kwang Chol, who fled to the South last year, told a forum of rights activists that the practice of killing newborns was widespread, but denied that he himself took part in it. Quote, "There are no people with physical defects in North Korea." He went on and said, "Babies born with physical disabilities were killed in infancy in hospitals or in homes and were quickly buried. The practice is encouraged by the state as a way of purifying the masses and eliminating people who might be considered different." Now, folks, let's look at this. First of all, in India, you have sex selection abortions being criminalized. And even though this is the first of any prosecutions and convictions on this issue in India, at least there is some progress being made there, as if for no other reasons than the imbalance between the genders. The state there in India has understood the problem. But in North Korea, we're now being told it's not just abortion, it is active infanticide, that there are no disabled persons there because doctors, as a matter of state encouragement and state policy, are simply killing newborns who are considered different or defective or disabled. Now, I asked a question in my weblog today. I said, is this logic all that far from what we now hear in America? Here, the majority of babies with Down syndrome are now aborted before they are born. The question is this: can infanticide be far behind? If we have now reached the point in this culture where we are satisfied that our neighbors are aborting babies with Down syndrome before they're born, how long will it be before we even argue that there is a duty that such babies should not be allowed to be born and should not be brought as a burden on the society, and therefore infanticide could quickly be practiced here as well? If you think that's some kind of dire and reckless prediction, just follow how quickly these issues have developed in other countries, where we've gone from A to B to C in terms of a line of atrocities, and all very quickly. We're not talking India here, we're not talking North Korea. In the Netherlands, forms of infanticide are now state-approved, where the baby is understood to be suffering from a terminal disease and may be suffering also from pain. Of course, all this rather subjective, and in the hands of doctors who are demeaning their profession. We need to be taking a clear account of all of this, because when we're dealing with an issue like abortion or infanticide, we're dealing with something that can appear very far away. You're talking about India, we're talking about North Korea, even the Netherlands. That can seem very abstract and far away. But folks, the logic of this is already taking root in the United States of America. Already in this country, you can hear persons making such arguments, whether it's Peter Singer, who of all things holds a chair of biomedical ethics at Princeton University, or if it's someone John Robertson, the University of Texas, talking about procreative liberty. You're hearing the logic of many of these positions in our law schools and medical schools and universities, and that means it's going to filter down as well to the clinical level, unless the moral conscience of this nation is awakened. Some of you may have awakened this morning to find a headline that disturbed you somewhat. The New York Times headline is this: long-awaited medical study questions the power of prayer. Well, let me just suggest that you shouldn't get too upset about this. The headline is followed by the introductory graph in the New York Times story: prayers offered by strangers had no effect on the recovery of people who are undergoing heart surgery, a large and long-awaited study has found, end quote. Now, this multi-million dollar study undertaken by the Templeton Foundation and involving universities like Columbia University in New York and the University of Oklahoma has been controversial from the start. There have been reports leaked out earlier that suggested just the opposite, that prayer really does help heal, etc. And there have been Christians who were excited about those stories, and now those same Christians are likely to be very upset about this. Let me just suggest a couple of principles to you. Number one, we don't verify theology by scientific statistics. That is the wrong model to look for validation. We should not be looking to the scientific or medical community to answer the question about the validity of prayer. But secondly, just remember that we as Christians do not believe in prayer as some kind of generic exercise, some kind of mental game. And so when we're talking about prayer, we're not talking about just some exercise of self-directed meditation. We're talking about a conversation between the creature and the Creator. Now, why is that so important here? Well, when you start looking at this study, and by the way, I have the actual study here in my hands, as well as the reports from several newspapers. When you look at this, they were using three different groups. One was prayed for and knew it. One was prayed for and didn't know it. And one wasn't prayed for. And they're suggesting that the outcomes from these three different groups had nothing to do with the prayer. And if you look at it, that just might be so. Because, listen, remember, we do not believe that prayer heals. We believe that God heals. We believe that prayer is the God-ordained means whereby we communicate as creatures with Him. But just as faith must have an object, we're not saved by faith, we're saved by faith in Christ. Let's remember that faith must have an object. So must prayer have an object, a partner. We're talking to someone, and we're not talking to some great beyond, and we're not talking to ourselves. This isn't some kind of yoga or Eastern meditation. We are speaking to the one who made us, and the one, I love this, as Martin Luther said, with whom we have to do. And this is the one who can heal, and we know that He is sovereign and can do all things, and that is simply outside the purview of any scientific study. So just remember, the next time you hear some study that says, look, prayer does work, you better ask this: what kind of prayer and to whom? And when you hear the prayer doesn't, just remember, it's the same question all over again. Let me tell you this, you don't have to pray about the study, but as a believer, just pray. We'll be back to talk about the one-year anniversary of Terri Schiavo. Have we learned anything? Coast to Coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back, folks. This is the one-year anniversary of the death of Terri Schiavo. We were really on a death watch for a number of days, you'll remember, last year, because once the feeding and hydration tubes had been removed by court order after all appeals, it was not a matter of if she would die, but when she would die. And let's just rehearse a couple of the facts of this case so that we know. It was several years before, 14 years before her death, that she suffered a catastrophic injury. We're not sure exactly how that injury came about. All kinds of speculation there. Whatever, it happened. And in the course of that injury, she lost a great deal of circulation to the brain, and she suffered undeniable brain injury. No question about that. She then was kept alive, and all that was necessary to keep her alive was feeding and hydration, that is, tubes going into her. She was able to swallow. She was able to breathe on her own. She was not brain dead. And there was much medical debate about whether or not she was in a persistent vegetative state. But the reality is that whether or not she was in a classical PVS, she was a human being who was not dying of her injury, but was being simply kept alive with the basic human elements, the elements for human life of water and hydration. Her parents, of course, wanted to keep her alive, but her husband had been in a multi-year battle in the courts to seek her death. Now, very interesting things played into this. Number one, he claimed that she had made statements during her conscious life suggesting that if anything like this were ever to happen to her, she would want to die. She would not want feeding and hydration. And that was accepted by the court, the local court there in Pinellas County, Florida. It was then sustained by successive courts of appeal. And you'll remember, as the situation went on and as the court order date appeared and neared, it became a matter of national controversy. The Florida legislature attempted to step in. The U.S. Congress attempted to step in. President George W. Bush attempted to step in, but were thwarted by successive federal courts, throwing it back to the local court there in Pinellas County, Florida, where Judge Greer continued to stand by his decision in saying that he was honoring Terri Schiavo's personal autonomy in honoring the demand of her husband, speaking as her agent, to end feeding and hydration, and she died on March 31, 2005. Now, I have to tell you that there was so much confusion about her case and the moral issues involved at the time that I was very frustrated. When I heard the media talking about this, and I was involved on several of the national programs talking about this, I was continually frustrated, first of all, about the debate about whether or not she was in a persistent vegetative state. Number one, we would never, ever concede that even if she were undeniably in a persistent vegetative state, that she should be denied feeding and hydration. So that's really a moot point. But it became a major point of media interest. And then the big issue was really missed in this, wasn't it? About personal autonomy. Because there were some who tried to say, look, Terri never actually said that she would want this done during her life. This is her husband simply speaking out of his will for her to die rather than her will to die. And thus, there's a question about the validity of his representation of her wishes. Again, that is not legally a moot point, but morally it is. Because even if she had suggested that she would not want feeding and hydration, the basic question for the Christian conscience is this. Does any human being have the right to forfeit even one's own life under such circumstances? Robert P. George teaches jurisprudence and American life at Princeton University. He's one of the main legal intellectuals in America today, one I greatly respect. He's been on this program several times. He holds the McCormick Chair of Jurisprudence at Princeton, where he's also director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. And in comments he made just in recent weeks, he has spoken, I think very eloquently, about the fact that the Terri Schiavo case indicates that a large number of Americans are now willing to identify human beings as non-persons, and by that implying that at some point they are pre-persons and at other points they are post-persons. The logic that was accepted in the case of Terri Schiavo is that at some point she had been a person. And that meant she was able to exercise her autonomy. Given the essentialist definition of human life, she had been able to communicate, to develop relationships, to envision the future. Those are Peter Singer's criteria. And thus she was recognized as a person. But once she suffered this brain injury, even though she was still the same body, even though she was still the same brain, now injured, and humanly speaking, she was still the same person, she's no longer a person, she's now a post-person, according to this mentality, because she's no longer characterized by those things that would make a person, and then justify the claim to an objective claim to life. So what we have in America is a great divide now between those who believe that the sanctity of human life trumps personal autonomy and those who believe that personal autonomy trumps the sanctity of human life. And don't underestimate the importance of this divide. Because where you stand on that question is going to determine where you come down on abortion, euthanasia, infanticide, embryo research, and any number of other issues. What is a human embryo? Is it a person or a pre-person? If you believe it's a pre-person, then you can go ahead and advocate destroying it, using it in medical experimentation or whatever. If you believe it's a person, you cannot. If you believe that at some point during the development, a non-person or a pre-person becomes a person, when exactly does that happen? When does a person become a post-person? Listen, with the society around us aging as fast as it is, with persons living into advanced years, with persons losing capacities, with Alzheimer's disease and any number of things, we're going to have millions of human beings in nursing homes and hospitals across America that at least a lot of the population are ready to call post-persons. They may not use that label, they may not use that language, but that's exactly the sum and substance of their argument. I want to know this. A year later, after Terri Schiavo's death, have we learned anything? I want to go back to something that was written in 1992. In 1992, a group at Princeton University, they met there, known as the Ramsey Colloquium, and it was named for Paul Ramsey, the longtime Christian ethicist at Princeton, came together to try to determine how these things should be defined. I want to read to you from their statement. Again, this was 1992, before some of this was even technologically envisionable. They said this: life is not a good that we possess. We are living beings. Our life is our person. To treat our life as a thing that we can authorize another to terminate is profoundly dehumanizing. Euthanasia, even when requested by the competent, can never be a humanitarian act, for it attacks the distinctiveness and limitations of being human. Persons, ourselves and others, are not things to be discarded when they are no longer deemed useful. That's exactly right. Prophetic words written in 1992 when some of this was just out on the horizon, but we are now arriving at the brave new world right on our threshold. A year ago, it ended in the tragedy of the death of Terri Schiavo. Have we learned anything? The phone number, 877-893-8255. I want you to join this conversation. What do you hear in your family, at your workplace, in your church, with your neighbors? Have we learned anything over the last year? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The Ramsey Colloquium statement goes on to read this: we can give our life for another, but we cannot give ultimate authority over our life to another. The painfully learned moral wisdom of our heritage is that persons cannot own persons. The decision for euthanasia is not an exercise of human freedom, but the abandonment of human freedom. To attempt to turn one's life into an object that is at the final disposition of another is to become less than human, while it places the other in a position of being more than human, a lord of life and death, a possessor of the personhood of others. That's exactly what the court in Pinellas County recognized in the case of Michael Schiavo. They recognized that he was the possessor of the life of his wife. Saying that they were honoring her personal autonomy, they ended up honoring his personal autonomy, and at his insistence, backed up by the collusion of the courts, she was denied feeding and hydration, and she died the death of one who starves and thirsts to death in a hospice or nursing home in Pinellas County, Florida. A year later, have we learned anything? The phone number for your conversation and your calls coast to coast is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
You know, folks, and in the aftermath of Terri Schiavo's death, I was amazed how quickly the story just went away from the front pages and went away from our national conversation. It seemed almost abrupt. She's dead. Those who fought for her life mourned the tragedy. Others simply decided to move on to other concerns. A year later, it seems like a lot longer than that to me, quite frankly, because there's been so little conversation about her death. Let me tell you, I picked up a couple of biomedical journals over the last couple of months, and looking back at the Terri Schiavo case, they've been pretty brutal, just looking back and suggesting that to hear again, the problem is that grassroots people got involved. What business do they have doing this? You know, it's another reminder to all of us that those who would be the high priests of medical ethics are often the last people you want making these decisions because their worldview is just so very different. And then in Washington, today the big conversation about Terri Schiavo has not been about Terri Schiavo. It's been about George W. Bush and Republicans in leadership in the House and in the Senate who tried to intervene. And, you know, I saw some editorials this morning and overnight saying, let's hope they learned never to try that again. Well, I'm afraid they learned never to try that again. I'm really afraid that the political backlash out of all of that really will intimidate a lot of political leaders in stepping in on the cause of life. The phone number is 877-893-8255. The question is, have we learned anything over the last year? Are you concerned about what you're hearing? Are you concerned that you're not hearing anything? How has your thinking perhaps shifted over the last year in thinking about the Terri Schiavo crisis? Were a situation like this to emerge in the national consciousness again, would you believe, as you did in the case of Terri Schiavo, that her life deserved to be protected by whatever means, legislative, judicial, you name it? Or do you think that what we learned as a nation is that this is something that Americans are now willing to bargain away? The phone number, 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Adam calling from McQuan, Wisconsin, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Adam.
Oh, I think the one thing that we've learned is that the fight's going to be tough and that we're not really dealing with liberty here. We're dealing with humanism. And the one thing that I've learned, at least, is that we can't take ourselves and put ourselves in God's place, that we have to be relying on God for issues such as this and for things like that, because when you... when it boils right down to it, they might say, well, we want liberty, but what they really want is they want to be God and put themselves in God's place. And I think that, you know, it's really a sad and dangerous thing, and we've got quite an uphill battle. That's at least what I've learned from it.
Yeah, Adam, I think what you've learned is what I've learned, and I appreciate the insight in your call. And I appreciate the way you've used the word liberty here, because there is this basic libertarian streak in the American soul, you might even say, in this American culture, which people say, look, government should not intrude in such things. But let's remember that in order to get this court order, Michael Schiavo had to go to the courts. It was a political question before those who would defend her life entered this political debate. And Adam, you're exactly right. Those who consider liberty, just a secular vision of liberty, to be the greatest good, they can't deal with questions of life and death. They can't deal with questions of medical ethics like this at the beginning or the end of life. And to go back to what we talked about earlier with pre-persons and post-persons, you know, those persons are presumed not to possess the kind of liberty that that those who are pressing, I think, on the wrong side of the Terri Schiavo controversy were trying to champion. Thanks for listening in McQuan, Wisconsin. Adam, thanks for calling. Let's go to Terrence calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Terrence.
Yes, I just wanted to see how you felt about, I know that right after the Terri Schiavo incident that, you know, it was increasing people who actually put their wishes and wills and things like that. And if their wishes go against what your basic principles are, do you think that they should be respected?
Yeah, you know, Terrence, you raise a very good question about living wills. Also, documents known as advanced directives. Let me just offer you a couple of words about that. Number one, I have to go back to where I was arguing earlier that it is wrong to claim autonomy in order to forfeit one's life under a situation in which one would not die of the injury, in this case with euthanasia, any way you want to define it. And so even if one correctly left one's wishes in a way that was correctly interpreted by those who were making moral decisions in the future, I would certainly not commend, and I could not commend, an advance directive that I think would direct those making those decisions the wrong way. But secondly, on this program, we've dealt with the advance directive and living will situation and come back again and again. We've had attorneys and medical specialists on who've indicated that those things are almost impossible to arrange in such a way that they cover all the actual possibilities that may clinically appear. And furthermore, those who are actually making the decisions may not even know of this advance directive and may not have it, or it may not be legally valid in the view of the one who's making the decisions. So it's not enough. Terrence, I appreciate the call. The phone number, 877-893-8255. Live from Sandestin, Florida, I'm Albert Moeller. And we are back from Sandestin, Florida, trying to mix some business and pleasure. I took my 13-year-old son fishing for 20 whole minutes this afternoon. That's right, 20 minutes of fishing. The fish are still laughing at us. They saw us coming. We barely got our hooks and everything wet. And the fish are still talking to each other about the two guys that showed up, fished for 20 minutes and left out of frustration. But we'll be back. We'll be back, and those fish will be threatened all over again, and we hope to have some good time in doing that as well. We're talking today, however, about the one-year anniversary of Terry Schiavo's death. It happened here in Florida, Pinellas County, St. Petersburg area. It was a year ago, March 31, 2005. The conscience of the nation seemed to be awakened for several days and weeks during that controversy, not necessarily in a good way, but there was a real sense in which this was a life-or-death argument being played out before our eyes. But once Terry died, that story was really swept from the national news media. One reason was that right after her death, in a matter of hours, Pope John Paul II died, and that became an international news event. And yet there never was really a closure to the Terry Schiavo case. And that's why a year later, I'm asking the question. I want you to answer the question. Have we learned anything over the last year? At my website at albertmuller.com, a major commentary published today in which I make the case that I think we've learned that this worldview of personal autonomy has gained even more ground over the last year. I think should a situation like this emerge again, and it will, it's happening actually all over America, just not with the kind of publicity that accompanied the Terry Schiavo case. I think if that kind of public controversy were to emerge, we might be surprised how much ground we've lost. I hope I'm wrong. I just fear that I'm right, because as I listen to Americans talking about this, I hear things that frighten me, quite frankly, even from Christians who should know better, who are beginning to buy into this autonomy argument because it's the very air we breathe here in the United States of America. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There's still time for you to call. We're going to go to Victor calling from Chattanooga, Tennessee, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Victor.
Hi, Al. Thank you so much for taking my call. We have become a nation of convenience, and which we have been for a while, I think, and we've also become a nation of disposability. You know, where it was, we're seeing the after effects and the long and winding effects of Roe v. Wade and the after effects of that, where, you know, it's all about convenience. It's all about your personal convenience and the things that you can do to improve your life, even after you've made mistakes so much. You know, if someone was in a, you know, situation where a young lady got pregnant and then it's just, hey, I can conveniently go have an abortion. We're seeing that now with the effects of Terry Schiavo and, you know, the shadow that has cast on our nation is quite scary, as you've said, and it's I'm not sure what can change it except for possibly as a Christian I could see, you know, a biblical or a Christian worldview, and I know that's not something that's going to go over very popular with many people in this nation.
You know, Victor, I think you said so much wisdom just in a very short amount of time there. I think you're right. I think the disposability of our culture that has now been extended to human lives is one of the scariest things. That's why in this particular program, before we ever got to talking about Terry Schiavo, I wanted to talk about the situation in North Korea, in which you have the infanticide of babies who are just considered to be not worthy of life. And it goes right back to the Germans, the Weimar German medical culture of Lebens und Wertensleben, life unworthy of life, that the Nazis picked up, led right to the concentration camps. And it's so easy for us to say that couldn't happen here. But it is happening here. It's happening in the womb right now, and a genocide of the unborn. And it's happening with over 40 million unborn babies aborted. And, of course, it's happening because a lot of people consider them, just as Robert P. George of Princeton says, as pre-persons, not as persons. They may one day be persons, the argument goes, but they're not persons now, and thus they do not possess any inherent dignity or claim to the sanctity of human life. Thanks for your call, Victor. Keep thinking this way. Keep talking to your neighbors. And as a Christian, as you said, let's keep working on how the Christian worldview has to respond to this. And it's a real shame if local churches aren't being concerned about these issues. How are Christians supposed to have any knowledge of how they are to think about this? Let's go to Jan calling from Houston, Texas, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Jan.
Hi. I'm calling regarding the conversation you've been having. I work as a registered nurse in Houston, and I have dealt with hospice patients quite a bit in my past. And to me, being starved to death or dehydrated to death is a horrible way to go. We work very hard to make the passing of individuals comfortable when there's nothing else we can do to help them, but to intentionally let it happen is not God's will. I've changed my living will. I've had my husband change his living will, and I've included advance directives that I don't want to be starved to death or dehydrated to death.
Now, Jan, you have a real credibility to speak to this, being a registered nurse and working in the environment where you are treating and assisting patients in situations very much like Terry Schiavo, and we could come up with a myriad of other clinical situations, injuries, and illnesses that could create a similar condition. Jan, when you look back at the Terry Schiavo controversy, what did the nation miss, you think, in understanding that situation? You know, how did it pass with so little notice after she died?
Mainly because it bothers people to think about being starved to death is what I would think. It's easier to push it under the rug and say it's not going to happen. It's happened. You know, it's over. Let's not dwell on it because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right. I think a lot of Americans decided it was just too uncomfortable an issue to envision what would happen as a woman starved to death and died of dehydration. It was just easier to think about something else. And, you know, this world will give you something else to think about in a big hurry. Just turn on cable news or just get in a conversation with your neighbor. And the next thing you know, you're on to something else. And we can put this out of sight and out of mind. That's why I wanted to do this program today. I think a year later, we've got to go back and ask what happened, how did it happen, how do we allow this to happen, and why a year later have we as Americans and even as American Christians apparently learned so little about all of this. Jan, thanks so much for your call. It's great to hear from you there in Houston, Texas. And I appreciate you calling with that expertise of being a registered nurse dealing right with these issues. And once again, Jan raised the issue of an advance directive, and she said something that I hope you heard. She said she changed her advance directive and also the directive of her husband so that they were very clear that they did not want to be starved or dehydrated under a similar circumstance. And, you know, that's, I think, about the best one can do is to be very clear about the fact that one does not want to be euthanized, that you do not want to be starved or dehydrated under a similar circumstance. And even as you would work at arranging that advanced directive or living will or whatever you want to call it, you recognize it's only as good as the medical professionals and those who have charge of your life will recognize. You know, that's why the stewardship of life has to be such a deep part of our entire culture. Why we must, as Christians, understand that this isn't something we can just take up when it's convenient or when it's, frankly, a part of our own family. We have to take it up when it's the cause of any life, anywhere, because it's about all of us. I'll be back with some final thoughts. This is Albert Moeller. It was Robert Louis Stevenson who described to be a human being as to be homo mirabilis, that is, the one who has a memory. We are the beings who remember. That's an important part of what it means, at least functionally, to be human. First thing we want to say is to lose one's memory doesn't make one less than human. It just makes one impaired as a human being. We know that memory is a part of what we live out of, and memory is often sparked by anniversaries. And the one-year anniversary, the death of Terry Schiavo, is an occasion for our memory. We need to go back a year ago, 12 months ago today, and think about where we were and ask the hard question, what have we learned in the midst of this? I'll tell you something I've learned over the last year. I have learned that Americans will move on from a tragedy like this all too quickly. Now, to be fair, the last year has been filled with all kinds of extremely newsworthy events. Numerous deaths, numerous incidents. You had just in the same period, of course, Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita and some of the other huge stories, political stories, environmental stories, and all the rest. But nothing is more important than the sanctity of human life. And the one thread that runs through all of these controversies and stories is the value of human life. That was one of the big arguments in the Katrina episode. That's one of the big arguments right now, whether you're talking about euthanasia or abortion or whatever. And I learned over the last year that Americans will quickly turn the channel and move on to something else. And I think our nurse from Houston who called is exactly right. I think it's because a lot of people just don't want to look this in the face for what it is. I learned something else. I learned there are a lot of Christians who would really rather not put the kind of intellectual effort into thinking these things through on a biblical frame. I think we are a lot of pastors who never said a word about this. And I'm just embarrassed for pastors who went into the tall grass and never said a word about this, because to fail to speak to an issue like this, especially to one's congregation, is to leave Christians having no clue about how to think Christianly about such a question. And I've learned something else. I've learned that there are a lot of people out there who are desperately frightened about what this means for our country. I've talked to a lot of people who are decision makers and leaders who say, you know, what I learned is that the American public will let something like this happen. That's one thing we learned. The American people will let something like this happen. Ultimately, we can't blame the judges. We can't blame the politicians, the legislators. Ultimately, we can't blame Michael Schiavo, although he will answer for this. Ultimately, we have to answer for why we as a people allowed this to happen. And here's the big question now. Would we allow it to happen again? Is it happening right now, off our screen, outside our attention, off the nation's airwaves? I wonder if it certainly must be even now. We began the show talking about abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research. And our main topic today has been Terry Schiavo. These are issues that are not going to go away. These are issues as relevant as every family's medical decisions and as our personal responsibility as Christians to be ready to give a Christian answer to these pressing controversies. We'll be back Monday to join you, and every day next week, live from Sandestin, Florida, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.